Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey/Movie Night in Canada. You're listening to CITR 101.9.
Good morning. I am Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk.
I believe that I'm as capable of as much bitterness as anybody else has. Maybe it doesn't find self-expression. I know that we do have a lot of choice, in that on the banquet table of life, there is a poison, and there is anger, and there is violence, and there's all that stuff we can ingest if we wish. We can also choose good stuff to eat. We can transform the horrible stuff and realize that it can be made into good stuff. And so these are our choices. And at some point, I'm just aware that, well, there is this saying, if you bring forth that which is within you, that which you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth that which is within you, that which you do not bring forth will destroy you. And I do know that, so that I believe that the creative process is necessary for one's non-self-destruction. So I believe that I'm called to write. I believe that everybody has a calling. And I think that wherever our terror is an indication of where we need to go. So that I will go there to what terrifies me. And the more you do that, I think the stronger you get in that direction into which you are supposed to go.
That was the voice of Joy Kogawa, a Canadian poet and novelist from Vancouver, best known for her semi-autobiographical novel, Aubusson. The novel chronicles Canada's internment and persecution of its citizens of Japanese descent during World War II from the perspective of a young child. Today, I speak with Professor Tara Lee from the UBC Department of English, who will discuss her own research interest in Asian Canadian literature, as well as her motivation for and philosophy in teaching it. She will also answer the question, what can you do with an English degree besides teach? You are tuned in to Prof Talk. Good morning, Tara. Welcome to Prof Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard the voice of author Joy Kogawa. I read her novel Aubusson in my adolescence, but when I think back, I don't remember reading other literary works written by Asian Canadians. Do you perceive there to be a lack of Asian Canadian or Asian North American representation in literature, theater, art, or film?
It's kind of interesting that you say that, because when you're in a field, you assume that everyone knows what you know. And it's good to hear that there are different perspectives. In fact, Asian Canadian literature is incredibly vibrant. Now is a growing, exciting time as a lot of new writers are coming onto the scene. So someone like Joy Kogawa is one of the pathfinders, one of those people that really forged the territory, got her novel published, broke the silence, told her story about the Japanese-Canadian internment, and really forged the way for other Asian-Canadian writers to come onto the scene and tell their stories. I think part of the reason why a lot of people aren't aware of Asian-Canadian literature, unlike kind of geeks like me who obsess over it, is because of this dominance of Canadian literature. When we think of Canadian literature, we think of people like, you know, Margaret Lawrence, Margaret Atwood. So if you went up to someone on the street and said, who is Margaret Atwood? The response would be quick, instantaneous. If you went up to someone and said, do you know who Joy Kogawa is? Maybe they would say something like, well, oh yes, I read that in high school. You know, we had to read it in high school, you know, as a required Asian Canadian text about the Japanese Canadian internment. But then if you start pushing it further, you know, and if you ask people things like, you know, have you read Hiromi Goto? Have you read Cary Sakamoto? Have you read Larissa Lai? There still might be some people who would say yes, and increasingly so. But still, there would still be some people who might not be as familiar with it, because Asian Canadian literature has always been a little bit more marginal to the larger Can-Lit canon. More people are learning about Asian Canadian texts and Asian Canadian literature classes, and also Asian Canadian literature specialists are also entering the university system and teaching courses, and even teaching Asian Canadian texts within Can-Lit courses. Mm-hmm. So the exposure is growing. Whether this is a good thing or not is debatable, but at the same time, exposure is growing. And then also, you know, on the more mainstream front, Asian Canadian writers are growing in profile. You know, so someone like Cary Sakamoto has published 2 novels to great critical acclaim. And someone like Larissa Lai, 2 novels as well. And so those writers are growing in profile. And so more and more people are interested in reading works on Asian-Canadian identity, on the issues that face Asian-Canadian writers. So the profile is increasing. I'm quite excited about it as well.
Now, how are Asian Canadians represented in literature and in popular media? So as a people, do you feel that, I mean, apart from the literature, how about, for example, in film or in television, do you see that also there are more Asian Canadians for example, on television now or in film? Like, how would you say they are represented?
Part of the reason why I promote various cultural producers like Larissa Lai or Lai Wan, an artist I'm working with right now, who's a filmmaker, a poet, an artist, is that they're battling against particular representations that are appearing in popular media like film and television shows, magazines. Representations that aren't always flattering in the sense that they tend to stereotype and pigeonhole Asian Canadians within a particular box, or Asian North Americans into a particular box. So, you know, if you take Asian men, a lot of the stereotypes in terms of Asian men as being either gangsters, and we see that happening a lot in newspapers today in terms of questions about gang warfare and pigeonholing Asian men as these thugs in gangs. So they're either the mafia men, you know, the gung-fu superstars, or they're emasculated. They're the weak mommy boys who don't have a clear identity of their own and don't have a clear masculinity like other men. So those sorts of portrayals are very limiting and are not allowing Asian men to get parts that are nuanced, that are complex, that show them as individuals, like these particular novels or other works that I teach and study do. And in terms of women, we get another set of oppositions. On the one hand, the women are highly sexualized. They're kind of like the Ling characters in Ally McBeal, the very hard-edged, over-sexualized women who tend to take control, tend to dominate, but not necessarily in a positive light. Or they're the geishas, the small, delicate, lotus-blossom geishas who submit to their masters. And we see that occurring as well. So, you know, something like Memoirs of a Geisha that plays off of that submissive, still sexualized role of an Asian woman. And so those sorts of roles, on the one hand, give Asians visibility within film, definitely. You know, they're there, they're on screen. But the question is that visibility really a good thing? Or does it just limit us even more and make it even harder for writers like Skyly, like Fred Waugh, to break out of that mold and to present stories that are different and to allow people to actually see that Asians aren't geishas? They're not all karate masters, and that they're more than that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you completed your doctorate degree at Simon Fraser 3 years ago, or Simon Fraser University, what aspect of your research focused on defining the Canadian, one aspect of your research focused on defining the Canadian citizen in relation to a much larger global space, so a kind of transnational identity? What do you mean by that?
Do you want to know the answer? I think what I was looking at was this movement from the national to the transnational. So I'll start by defining the national, and then we'll move into what I call the transnational. So I was looking at early texts like Skyly's Disappearing Moon Cafe, Joy Kagawa's Obasan, and I was looking at them and thinking about how early works in the 1980s, say, were focusing on the relationship between Asian-Canadian characters and the nation. So this real obsession with trying to find a place within Canada for Asian Canadians. I am Asian Canadian. I belong here. So carving a home, a space, a location, a place of identity for Asian Canadians. And part of this was because of systemic racism that didn't allow Asian Canadians to claim citizenship within the nation, didn't allow them to even claim a home. Japanese Canadians were displaced to other places because they were deemed enemy aliens. So that kind of intense racism, marginality, caused this desire to represent within the literature a place within the nation. So then my dissertation traced the movement from those earlier texts to more recent texts that have shifted, and that have shifted with the times. Of course, there still is racism with Canada. There still is a problematic relationship between Asian Canadians and the Canadian nation and Canadian nation state. But things have shifted in the sense that a lot of us are really global. We're connected to people all around the world. We travel like never before. We don't really view borders in the same way. Borders in many ways are blurring, shifting. You know, certain people, I've asked them, you know, where do you belong? And they say, you know, I'm a global citizen. Sometimes I'm living here, sometimes I'm living there. You know, I email people from far away. I have friends on Facebook from all over the globe. So I really am a global citizen. Mm-hmm. So Asian Canadian literature has responded to that by presenting characters who are leaving Canada and testing their identities elsewhere. So, for example, in Kiri Sakamoto's new novel, or more recent novel, she was looking at a character who traveled outside of Canada to Japan to look at kamikaze pilots and that particular history there. And so the identities shift. Larissa Lai's novel takes place in what is ostensibly Vancouver, so it stays within Canada, but at the same time, it's very global or transnational in perspective, in the sense that the novel is set in a place in which corporations rule, these transnational corporations, in which characters eat genetically modified food, in which technology plays a huge role, so that in many ways the works now reflect our lives today, lives that are transnational, relying on technology, relying on science in different ways. So there's this explosion of identity, and there's a huge question mark. What happens to our relationship to Canada when suddenly, you know, we're globe-trotting everywhere, we have friends around the world? What happens to Asian-Canadian identity when that sort of explosion happens? So there are a lot of fundamental questions. What happens to identity when suddenly we're implanting animal genes into things like fruit and things like that. So a lot of complex questions.
Mm-hmm. Now, what motivates you to teach Asian Canadian literature, and what kinds of reactions do you receive from your students in the subject area?
Well, when I was trying to decide what to specialize in, I had two loves, let's put it that way. I could have done English literature in the 18th century, so restoration literature and the 18th century literature, so things like Pamela and things like that. And I loved that. I loved it a lot. But I also had another love. I loved Canadian literature, and I loved especially minority Canadian literature, and narrowing it down even further, I loved Asian Canadian literature. So I was torn between the two. They were my two loves. And the reason why I eventually chose Can Lit and Asian Canadian literature was because it meant more to me in a different sort of way. It meant more because I had a personal stake in it. I could, in some cases, identify with identity struggles within the texts, and I also thought that by teaching and studying and writing about Asian Canadian literature, that I could make a difference in a different way. That, of course, I could make a difference teaching 18th century literature, but that with Asian Canadian literature, the questions were still really immediate, mm-hmm. that I could make connections to the world outside of the books, to the world outside of the classroom, to the world that the students in the classroom live, and that I could really change the way they saw themselves if they were Asian Canadian, and for those who weren't, really change how they see Asian Canadians and how they respond to those sorts of identities. So it was fundamentally important to me to see if I could teach and study something that would make an actual difference. So it may sound a little bit utopian, but actually, thinking back, that is why I chose it. So in the classroom, I try my best to do that. I don't know if it's always that successful. You know, some days it is, some days it isn't. Just the nature of teaching. But at the same time, that's my underlying desire. So, for example, this term I'm teaching a Canadian literature class, English 222, which is called Studies in Canada, which could be taught as, you know, a survey class. You know, we take our Canadian anthology, you know, we start at Rising Village, and then we move forward through Atwood, through Lawrence, you know, adding a little bit of Aubusson, a little bit of Hiromi Goto, and things like that, which, you know, is fair. But at the same time, I want to be a little bit more self-reflexive about it. So I want students to think about, okay, why is Margaret Atwood so dominant when it comes to Can Lit? Why is she so immediate? What is this thing, Can Lit? Where did it come from? Perhaps, who has it silenced by becoming so prominent? And then, who are those other voices? How is Can Lit changing? What does it mean that there are Asian Canadian literatures out there? What are their struggles? What are they trying to say? How are they representing themselves? And then more importantly, how are the students themselves responding to the works? What kinds of preconceptions are they bringing? Mm-hmm. What kinds of assumptions? And how are the works playing with those assumptions, getting them to see particular minority characters differently, getting them to think about identity differently, getting them to think even more importantly about Canada? What is Canadian identity in the 21st century, you know, at a time when there's global trade, technology, at a time when there are increasingly more visible minorities within the cities, when the face of Canada is changing? And so how does that literature respond to that? And then how can the classroom with these books respond to those very preoccupations? And so you're talking about responses. Mm-hmm. And so in some cases, you know, I get students that say, I'm taking Can Lit because I want to go into education and I have to take this course. And so we start off usually with that beginner. You know, a lot of students, admittedly, I don't like to think this, but admittedly, some of them only take it because they have to. So, I mean, I'm not naive. And so we start with that. And then we also start with the assumption, Canadian literature is boring. It's all about forests and pioneers and other stuff like that. And that can get really dull. And that's part of it. I work with that assumption, and then we go further. We show that there's more to Can Lit than trees. We show that Can Lit has been about trees because it's been a lot about pioneering, claiming that land, but also that claiming has displaced other people, like First Nations people. So we give them First Nations stories that challenge that assumption of Canadian literature, that pioneer mentality. Then we move into works like Dion Brand, who writes about young people, second generation immigrant children who live in Toronto, that are friends with graffiti artists, that have identities that are crazy and wild, and that bend gender and sexuality and questions of race and religion and language and all of that. And so there's a real opening up and a challenging of those, I think Can Lit is boring, thoughts that students bring to the class. And so I get excited too because I suddenly realize again why I went into the field, why I wanted to make a difference, and also how good the works can be and how exciting they can be, more so than snooze trees. Not that that's not an important part also.
Right. Now, I would like to talk to you about what you're currently doing besides teaching. I have a long list in front of me of some of your outside academic endeavors, which include being a freelance writer for several local publications. Can you tell us about some of your regular assignments?
Yeah, the reason why I wanted to talk about this so much is that I get a lot of students who come to me who are doing well, I have to be careful here, accounting or something like that. I can say this because I used to be an aspiring accountant. I did my undergraduate in commerce, in accounting. So I get students who come who want to be accountants or pharmacists or doctors or engineers. And they also have this secret closet love of English and English literature. And I'm not knocking those fields at all because they're fabulous. And I think it's wonderful if you have an actual passion for them. You know, I have friends who are accountants who actually have a passion for accounting, and I'm really proud of them, and I support them. But I'm talking about students who are taking accounting because their mom told them to, or not even told them to, required them to, or something like that, or are, you know, doing pharmacy because, you know, every drugstore needs a pharmacist, and they want a job after they graduate. And so they always say to me, well, what can I do with a literature degree or an English degree besides teach, like you do? And I usually answer by saying what I do outside of the university. Teaching is fabulous, and I love it, but there are other things as well besides that. If you have a little bit of drive, you push yourself a little bit more and see outside of the box. So an English degree gives you all those critical skills in terms of thinking, in terms of creativity, in terms of generating ideas. So seeing the world in a different light, and at the same time, a fundamental part of English literature and English degree is about writing. And there are a lot of people out there who can't write, a lot of companies that can't write. So they need you. They need you desperately. So I decided at one point after I finished my PhD that I wanted a new challenge. I wanted also a chance to explore other ways of expressing myself. So I wanted to do a little bit of writing outside of academic writing, just to, I guess, free myself for a little bit. And so I started doing food writing, which is actually as exciting as it sounds. So I write for publications like the Georgia Strait, Eat Magazine, City Food I've written for in the past. So all these different food publications, Northwest Palette. And I basically write about food in Vancouver, the food scene, restaurants, and things like that. So a recent article I did in the Georgia Strait was about Persian New Year.
Right.
So I had to write an article about Persian New Year. So basically I went to North Van, I walked around Lonsdale Avenue, I went into Persian grocery stores, I pestered the owners of the grocery stores to give me a tour, let me taste the chickpea cookies. I phoned people to find out about when Persian New Year events were happening in terms of bonfire jumping and things like that. And it used all of the skills that I get from an English degree. So basically, first of all, writing, you know, taking all those different clips and all those notes that I had taken and turning it into a story, a narrative that readers will enjoy. But also a huge part of English literature and a lot of humanities degrees is research. So I had to go out actively researching. First of all, researching before I actually went to North Vancouver to research the Persian New Year. So I had to Google, in some cases, look up books to find out a little bit more about Persian New Year and its cultural history. Mm-hmm. And then I actually had to actively research by talking to people. Mm-hmm. And part of English classes is also about doing presentations, being able to communicate effectively with other people, ask the right questions, to listen to what other people are saying and take down that pertinent information. Mm-hmm. So that's one example of one of the articles I recently wrote for the Georgia Strait and how it used all of my English skills.
Right. Now, what about, you've also had some involvement with the CBC Radio. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's kind of been a dream for me. It just happened. And the first thing I have done was host a book club, the Studio One book club, that is on North by Northwest with Cheryl McKay. And basically, they knew that I am a freelance writer, a freelance food writer, and they were having a cookbook author, Jeffrey Elford, come in. And he travels the world with his wife, and they basically have a dream job as well, in which they go to different countries and they collect recipes. They live in that country, live the life, and collect recipes. So in this case, this was a book with these gorgeous photographs, these absolutely gorgeous photographs. It's more like a coffee table book more than anything else. And so they were going to be coming, or he was going to be coming into the CBC studios, and I was going to get the chance to co-host this book club with Cheryl McKay, and I had to read the book ahead of time. Once again, English lit skill. Come up with questions, things that I wanted to ask, you know, particular themes that I saw occurring again and again in the book. Ask about the recipes, ask about Chinese cooking, all those different things. So what happened was we had a book club in which we invited the public. It's almost like a classroom setting. We had an audience who would sit, and Jeffrey Elford, Cheryl, and myself were at the front of the room, you know, with the mics. And Cheryl and myself would take turns asking Jeffrey questions, finding out more about this book, about his travels through China, in his book Beyond the Great Wall, how he collected recipes, how he's breaking stereotypes of Chinese cuisine. And then we would get the audience to ask questions as well. So there's a real facilitation there. And besides that, I'm now working on things like talk tapes. So basically what I do is I go out into the field and I collect clips from various people, audio clips from various people on various subjects. So I'm working on a talk tape on Lai Wan, who I mentioned earlier, who is a Chinese-Canadian artist, filmmaker, poet. And I collected clips on her more recent gallery contribution at the Vancouver Art Gallery. So I interviewed the curator of the Vancouver Art Gallery. Mm-hmm. I interviewed a bass clarinetist who she collaborated with in the past. I got sounds from one of her installations. What I'm doing now is I'm weaving that all together and then also having a conversation with Cheryl McKay, the host of North by Northwest, mm-hmm. about that topic. And so Lai Wan was in my dissertation. I know her intimately in that way. So it's an application of what I've been doing in the academic setting.
Exactly. Well, it has been great to talk with you. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you so very much. I enjoyed that.
All right. Take care. That was Professor Tara Lee from the UBC Department of English. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM or via live streaming on the web on citr.ca. Next week, I speak with Dr. Michael Hayden from the UBC Department of Medical Genetics. He will discuss his goals to understand how changes in specific genes result in specific diseases, usually in adult life, in particular Huntington disease and premature coronary artery disease. He will also discuss his Ripples of Hope Foundation that will bring trainees from Africa to Canada to study in several areas of global health. Today is the start of UBC International Week. It is a time to celebrate our strength as an international university. Through dialogue and the exchange of ideas, we create connections across disciplinary and national borders. International activities and perspectives are part of our campus life year-round. This week, however, is a spotlight on our global interconnections. Learn to connect, connect to learn is the theme for this year's International Week. The full event schedule can be found on www.ubciweek.com. And finally, if you would like to send us feedback of this show or any show that you hear on Prof Talk, you can email us at proftalk@gmail.com. And for a full schedule of future shows, you can visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. And you can download a podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. Stay tuned now for Breakfast with the Browns with your host, Peter. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening this morning. Talk to you next week.